How to Abolish War. The Plan. War grows out of the desire of the individual to gain advantage at the expense of his fellow men. And the smoldering embers of this desire are fanned into a flame through the grouping of these individuals who place the interests of the group above those of other groups. War cannot be stopped suddenly. It can be eliminated only by education, through the aid of the principle of subordination of the individual interests to the broader interests of the human race as a whole. Man's tendencies and activities, as we have already stated, grow out of the two great forces of physical heredity and social heredity. Through physical heredity, a man inherits these early tendencies to destroy his fellow men out of self-protection. This practice is a holdover from the age when the struggle for existence was so great that only the physically strong could survive. Gradually, man began to learn that the individual could survive under more favorable circumstances by aligning himself with others, and out of that discovery grew our modern society, through which groups of people have formed states, and these groups, in turn, have formed nations. There is but little tendency toward warfare between the individuals of a particular group or nation, for they have learned, through the principle of social heredity, that they can best survive by subordinating the interest of the individual to that of the group. Now the problem is to extend this principle of grouping so that the nations of the world will subordinate their individual interests to those of the human race as a whole. This can be brought about only through the principle of social heredity, by forcing upon the minds of the young of all races the fact that war is horrible and does not serve either the interest of the individual engaging in it or the group to which the individual belongs. The question then arises, how can this be done? Before we can answer this question, let us again define the term social heredity and find out what its possibilities are. Social heredity is the principle through which the young of the race absorb from their environment, and particularly from their earlier training by parents, teachers, and religious leaders, the beliefs and tendencies of the adults who dominate them. Any plan to abolish war, to be successful, depends on the successful coordination of effort between all the churches and schools of the world for the avowed purpose of so implanting the minds of the young with the idea of abolishing war that the very word war will strike terror in their hearts. There is no other way of abolishing war. The next question that arises is how can the churches and schools of the world be organized with this high ideal as an objective? The answer is that not all of them can be induced to enter into such an alliance at one time, but a sufficient number of the more influential ones can be induced, and this, in time, will lead or force the remainder into the alliance as rapidly as public opinion begins to demand it. One other question remains. Who will start the machinery of the United States government into action to call this conference? And the answer is public opinion. Universal peace between nations will grow out of a movement that will be begun and carried on, at first, by a comparatively small number of thinkers. Gradually, this number will grow until it will be composed of the leading educators, clergymen, and publicists of the world, and these, in turn, will so deeply and permanently establish peace as a world ideal that it will become a reality. This desirable end may be attained in a single generation under the right sort of leadership, but, more likely, it will not be attained for many generations to come, because those who have the ability to assume this leadership are too busy in their pursuit of worldly wealth to make the necessary sacrifice for the good of generations yet unborn. War can be eliminated not by appeal to reason, but by appeal to the emotional side of humanity. This appeal must be made by organizing and highly emotionalizing the people of the different nations of the world in support of a universal plan for peace. And this plan must be forced upon the minds of the oncoming generations with the same diligent care that we now force upon the minds of our young the ideal of our respective religions. It is not stating the possibilities too strongly to say that the churches of the world could establish universal peace as an international ideal within one generation if they would apply just one half of the effort that they now apply in opposing one another. In brief, if the present organized forces of the world will not lend their support to establishing universal peace as an international ideal, then new organizations must be created that will do so. It staggers the imagination what the leading churches of all religions, the leading schools, and the press of the world could accomplish within a single generation, enforcing the ideal of universal peace upon both the adult and the child minds of the world. The majority of the people of the world want peace, wherein lies the possibility of its attainment. Those who do not want peace are the ones who profit by war. In numbers, this group constitutes but a fragment of the power of the world and could be swept aside as though it did not exist if the multitude who do not want war were organized in their objective. In closing, it seems appropriate to apologize for the unfinished state of this essay, but it may be pardonable to suggest that the bricks and the mortar and the foundation stones and all the other necessary materials for the construction of the Temple of Universal Peace have been here assembled, where they might be rearranged and transformed into this high ideal as a world reality. Economics and social heredity. Let us now apply the principle of social heredity to the subject of business economy and ascertain whether or not it can be made of practical benefit in the attainment of material wealth. If I were a banker, I would obtain a list of all the births in the families within a given distance of my place of business, and every child would receive an appropriate letter congratulating it on its arrival in the world at such an opportune time, in such a favorable community, and from that time on would receive from my bank a birthday reminder of an appropriate nature. When the child was old enough to read, it would receive from my bank an interesting storybook in which the advantages of saving would be told in story form. If the child were a girl, she would receive, as a birthday gift, doll cutout books with the name of my bank on the back of each doll. If it were a boy, he would receive baseball bats. One of the most important floors of my bank would be set aside as a children's playroom, and it would be equipped with merry-go-rounds, slides, seesaws, scooters, games, and sandboxes, with a competent supervisor in charge. I would let that playroom become the popular habitat of the children of the community, where mothers might leave their youngsters in safety while shopping or visiting. I would entertain those youngsters so royally that when they grew up and became bank depositors whose accounts were worthwhile, they would be inseparably bound to my bank, and meanwhile, I would in no way be lessening my chances of making depositors of the fathers and mothers of those children. If I were the owner of a business school, I would begin cultivating the boys and girls of my community from the time that they reached the fifth grade on up through high school, so that by the time they were through high school and ready to choose a vocation, I would have the name of my business school well fixed in their minds. If I were a grocer or a department store owner or a druggist, I would cultivate the children, thereby attracting both them and their parents to my place of business. If I were a department store owner and took whole pages of newspaper ads, as most of them do, I would run a comic strip at the bottom of each page, illustrating it with scenes from my playroom, and in this way induce the children to read my advertisements. If I were a national advertiser or the owner of a mail order house, I would find appropriate ways and means of establishing a point of contact with the children of the country, for, let me repeat, there is no better way of influencing the parent than through the child. If I were a barber, I would have a room equipped exclusively for children, for this would also bring me the patronage of both the children and their parents. In every city, there is an opportunity for a flourishing business for someone who will operate a restaurant and serve quality home-cooked meals and cater to families who wish to bring the children. If I were operating it, I would have the place equipped with well-stocked fishing ponds, ponies, and all sorts of animals and birds to induce the children to come out regularly and spend the entire day. Why speak of gold mines when opportunities such as this are abundant? These are but a few of the ways in which the principle of social heredity might be used to advantage in business. Attract the children, and you attract the parents. If nations can build soldiers of war to order by bending the minds of their young in the direction of war, businessmen can build customers to order through the same principle. Alliances. We come now to another important feature of this lesson through which we may see, from another angle, how power may be accumulated by cooperative, organized effort. In the plan for the abolition of war, you observed how coordination of effort between three of the great organized powers of the world, the schools, the churches, and the press, might serve to force universal peace. We learned many lessons of value from the World War, outrageous and destructive as it was, but none of greater importance than that of the effect of organized effort. The tide of war began to break in favor of the Allied armies just after all armed forces were placed under the direction of General Foch, which brought about complete coordination of effort in the Allied ranks. Never before in the history of the world had so much power been concentrated in one group of men as that which was created through the organized effort of the Allied armies. One of the most outstanding and significant facts to be found in the analysis of these Allied armies is that they were made up of the most cosmopolitan group of soldiers ever assembled. Every race and religion was represented. If they had any differences on account of race or creed, they laid them aside and subordinated them to the cause for which they were fighting. Under the stress of war, that great mass of humanity was reduced to a common level where they fought shoulder to shoulder, side by side, without asking any questions as to one another's racial or religious beliefs. If they could lay aside intolerance long enough to fight for their lives over there, why can we not do the same while we fight for a higher standard of ethics in business and finance and industry over here? Is it only when civilized people are fighting for their lives that they have the foresight to put aside intolerance and cooperate in the furtherance of a common end? If it were advantageous to the Allied armies to think and act as one thoroughly coordinated body, would it be less advantageous for the people of a city or a community or an industry to do so? If all the churches and schools and newspapers and clubs and civic organizations of your city ally themselves for the furtherance of a common cause, do you not see how such an alliance would create sufficient power to ensure the success of that cause? Bring the idea still nearer your own interests by imagining in your own city an alliance between all of the employers and all of the employees for the purpose of reducing friction and misunderstandings, thereby enabling them to render better service at a lower cost to the public and greater profit to themselves. We learned from the World War that we cannot destroy a part without weakening the whole. That when one nation or a group of people is reduced to poverty and want, the rest of the world suffers also. As we also learned, cooperation and tolerance are the very foundation of enduring success. Surely, the more thoughtful and observant among us will not fail to profit, as individuals, by these great lessons. I realize that you are probably studying this course for the purpose of profiting in every way possible from a purely personal point of view by the principles upon which it is founded. For this very reason, I have endeavored to apply these principles to as wide a range of subjects as possible. In this lesson, you have had an opportunity to observe the application of the principles of tolerance, organized effort, and social heredity in ways that should have given you much to think about. I have endeavored to show you how these principles may be applied both in the furtherance of your own individual interests, in whatever you may be involved, and for the benefit of civilization as a whole. Whether your calling is that of preaching sermons, selling goods or personal services, practicing law, directing the efforts of others, or working as a day laborer, it seems not too much to hope that you will find in this lesson a stimulus to thought which may lead you to higher achievements. If you happen to be a writer of advertising copy, you will surely find in this lesson sufficient food for thought. If you offer personal services, it is not unreasonable to expect that this lesson will suggest ways and means of marketing those services to greater advantage. In pointing out some of the sources from which intolerance can develop, this lesson should also lead you to the study of other thought-provoking subjects, which might easily mark a most profitable turning point in your life. Books and lessons in themselves are of but little value. Their real value, if any, lies not in their printed pages, but in the possible action they may arouse in the reader. For example, when my proofreader had finished reading the manuscript of this lesson, she informed me that it had so impressed her and her husband that they intended to go into the advertising business and supply banks with an advertising service that would reach the parents through the children. She believes the plan is worth $10,000 a year to her. Frankly, her plan so appealed to me that I would estimate its value at a minimum of more than 3 times that amount. And I do not doubt that it would yield 5 times that amount if it were properly organized and marketed by a good salesman. That is not all this lesson has accomplished before passing from the manuscript stage. A prominent business college owner to whom I showed the manuscript has already begun to put into effect the suggestion of applying the principle of social heredity as a means of cultivating students. He also believes that a plan similar to the one he intends using could be sold to the majority of the 1,500 business colleges in the United States and Canada, and that it would yield the promoter of the plan a yearly income greater than the salary of the President of the United States. An important object of this course, and particularly of this lesson, is to educate more than it is to inform. It should awaken the power within you that awaits some appropriate stimulus to arouse you to action. In conclusion, I leave you with my personal sentiments on tolerance in the following essay, which I wrote in the hour of my most trying experience, when an enemy was trying to ruin my reputation and destroy the results of a lifetime of honest effort to do some good in the world. Editor's comment. An edited version of the essay that follows also appeared in Volume 2 of this revised edition and repeats here in its entirety. With the original 1928 edition of this book, and with the course on which it was based, a wall hanger of the essay was sent to each person who returned the personal analysis questionnaire that had been included with the book. Tolerance. When the dawn of intelligence shall have spread its wings over the eastern horizon of progress, and ignorance and superstition shall have left their last footprints on the sands of time, it will be recorded in the book of man's crimes and mistakes that his most grievous sin was that of intolerance. The bitterest intolerance grows out of racial and religious differences of opinion, as the result of early childhood training. How long, O master of human destinies, until we poor mortals will understand the folly of trying to destroy one another because of dogmas and creeds and other superficial matters over which we do not agree? Our allotted time on this earth is but a fleeting moment at most. Like a candle, we are lighted, shine for a moment, and flicker out. Why can we not so live during this short earthly sojourn that when the great caravan called death draws up and announces this visit about finished, we will be ready to fold our tents and, like the Arabs of the desert, silently follow the caravan out into the darkness of the unknown, without fear and trembling? I am hoping that I will find no Jews or Gentiles, Catholics or Protestants, Germans or Englishmen, Frenchmen or Russians, blacks or whites, reds or yellows. When I shall have crossed the bar to the other side, I am hoping I will find there only human souls, brothers and sisters all, unmarked by race, creed, or color, for I shall want to be done with intolerance, so I may lie down and rest an eon or two, undisturbed by the strife, ignorance, superstition, and petty misunderstandings which mark with chaos and grief this earthly existence. Lesson 16. The Golden Rule. You can do it if you believe you can. This lesson is the guiding star that will enable you to profitably and constructively use the knowledge assembled in the preceding lessons. For more than 25 years, I have been observing the manner in which people with power behave, and I have come to the conclusion that the person who attains it in any way other than by the slow, step-by-step process is constantly in danger of destroying themselves and all whom they influence. This entire course leads to the attainment of power, of proportions that may be made to perform the seemingly impossible. It becomes apparent, however, that this power can be attained only by the observance of many fundamental principles, all of which converge in this lesson, which is based on a law that both equals and transcends in importance every other law outlined in the preceding lessons. That power can endure only by faithful observance of this law, wherein lies the safety valve that protects the careless student from the dangers of their own follies. It also protects those whom they might endanger by trying to circumvent the injunction laid down in this lesson. To frivolously use the power that may be attained through the knowledge from the preceding lessons without a full understanding and strict observance of the law presented in this lesson is the equivalent of being reckless with the power that may destroy as well as create. I am speaking now not of what I suspect to be true, but of what I know to be true. I have observed the unvarying application of this truth in everyday life over all these years, and I have appropriated as much of it as, in the light of my own human frailties and weaknesses, I could make use of. If you want positive proof of the soundness of the laws upon which this course in general and this lesson in particular is founded, I can offer it only through one witness, and that is you. You may have positive proof only by testing and applying these laws for yourself. For more substantial and authoritative evidence than my own, I refer you to the teachings and philosophies of Christ, Plato, Socrates, Epictetus, Confucius, Emerson, and two of the more modern philosophers, James and Münsterberg, from whose works I have appropriated the more important fundamentals of this lesson, with the exception of what I have gathered from my own limited experience. From the editors. William James, psychologist and philosopher, as well as physician, Harvard professor, artist, religious thinker, psychic researcher, drug experimenter, writer, and lecturer, was born in New York City in 1842 and is considered to be the father of modern American psychology. His first book, The Principles of Psychology, advanced the functionalism movement and launched psychology as a separate field. It was perhaps the focus in James' work on the mind and on thought, habit, memory, imagination, hypnotism, and free will that most appealed to Napoleon Hill. First published in 1890, this book is still available in paperback. William James is the older brother of novelist Henry James. It was at the urging of William James that idealist German psychologist and philosopher Hugo Münsterberg came to the U.S. as a professor of psychology at Harvard. Combining his career and outside interests, Münsterberg wrote several books on such varied subjects as social issues, film, the criminal justice system, and Asian art, and many of these books are also still available. Returning to Napoleon Hill's original text. Do unto others. For more than 4,000 years, people have been preaching the Golden Rule as a suitable rule of conduct toward others. But while we have accepted the philosophy of it as a sound rule of ethical conduct, we have failed to understand the spirit of it or the law upon which it is based. The Golden Rule essentially means to do unto others as you would wish them to do unto you if your positions were reversed. There is an eternal law through the operation of which we reap what we sow. When you select the rule of conduct by which you guide yourself in your transactions with others, you will very likely be fair and just if you know that, by your selection, you are setting into motion a power that will run its course in the lives of others, returning, finally, to help or to hinder you, according to its nature. If you fully understood the principles described in Lesson 11, Volume 3, on accurate thinking, that one's thoughts are transformed into reality corresponding exactly to the nature of the thoughts, it will be quite easy for you to understand the law upon which the Golden Rule is based. You cannot divert or change the course of this law, but you can adapt yourself to its nature and thereby use it as an irresistible power that will carry you to heights of achievement which could not be attained without its aid. It is your privilege to deal unjustly with others, but if you understand this law, you must know that your unjust dealings will come home to roost. The law does not stop by merely flinging back upon you your acts of injustice and unkindness toward others. It goes further than this, much further, and returns to you the results of every thought that you release. Therefore, it is not enough to do unto others as you wish them to do unto you, but you must also think of others as you wish them to think of you. The law upon which the Golden Rule is based begins affecting you the moment you release a thought. It has amounted almost to a worldwide tragedy that people have not generally understood this. Despite the simplicity of the law, it is practically all there is to be learned that is of enduring value to man, for it is the medium through which we become the masters of our own destiny. Understand this law, and you understand all that the Bible has to unfold to you, for the Bible presents an unbroken chain of evidence in support of man being the maker of his own destiny, and his thoughts and acts being the tools with which he does the making. During ages of less enlightenment and tolerance than that of the present, some of the greatest thinkers the world has ever produced have paid with their lives for daring to uncover this law so that it might be understood by all. In light of the past history of the world, people are gradually throwing off the veil of ignorance and intolerance. And today, I stand in no danger of bodily harm for writing what would have cost me my life a few centuries ago. While this course deals with the highest laws of the universe that man is capable of interpreting, the aim, nevertheless, has been to show how these laws may be used in the practical affairs of life. With this object of practical application in mind, let us now proceed to analyze the effect of the Golden Rule through the following illustration of the power of prayer. The lawyer said, "No, I won't press your claim against that man. You can get someone else to take the case." The man bristled, "Think there isn't any money in it?" The lawyer replied, "There probably would be a little money in it, but it would come from the sale of the little house that the man calls his home. But I don't want to meddle with the matter anyhow." "Got frightened out of it, eh?"
"Not at all."
"I suppose the fellow begged hard to be let off," the lawyer conceded.
"Well, yes, he did."
"And you caved in?"
"Yes."
"What did you do?"
"I shed a few tears," confessed the lawyer.
"And the old fellow begged you hard, you say?"
"No, he didn't speak a word to me."
"Well then, whom did he address in your hearing?"
"God Almighty."
"He prayed to be let off?"
"Not for my benefit in the least. You see, when I went to the house, the front door was open. I knocked, but nobody heard me. So I stepped into the little hall and saw through the crack of a door a cozy sitting room. And there on the bed, with her silver head high on the pillows, was an old lady who looked for all the world just like my mother did the last time I ever saw her on earth. Down on his knees by her side was an old white-haired man, and I couldn't have knocked then for the life of me. Then he began. First, he reminded God they were still his submissive children, and no matter what he saw fit to bring upon them, they shouldn't rebel at his will. Of course, it was going to be very hard for them to go out homeless in their old age, especially with poor mother so sick and helpless. And oh, how different it all might have been if only one of the boys had been spared. Then his voice kind of broke, and a white hand stole from under the covers and moved softly over his snowy hair. Then he went on to repeat that nothing could be so painful again as the parting with those three sons, unless mother and he should be separated. But at last he comforted himself with the fact that the dear Lord knew that it was through no fault of his own that mother and he were threatened with the loss of their dear little home. And then he quoted a multitude of promises concerning the safety of those who put their trust in the Lord. In fact, it was the most moving plea to which I ever listened. And last, he prayed for God's blessing on those who were about to demand justice. The lawyer continued, more lowly than ever, "And I believe I'd rather go to the poorhouse myself tonight than to stain my heart and hands with such a prosecution as that."
"Afraid to negate the old man's prayer?"
"You couldn't negate it," said the lawyer. "He left it all to the will of God. He claimed that we were told to make known our desires unto God, and of all the pleadings I ever heard, that beat all. You see, I was taught that kind of thing myself in my childhood. Was I sent to hear that prayer? I am sure I don't know, but I hand the case over."
"I wish," said the client, twisting uneasily, "you hadn't told me about the old man's prayer."
"Why so?"
"Well, because I want the money the place would bring, and generally people's personal prayers don't enter into my business dealings. But I was taught the Bible when I was a youngster, too."
The lawyer smiled. "Maybe that's why I overheard it. Maybe it was meant for both of us to hear. My mother used to sing about God's moving in a mysterious way, as I remember it."
"Well, my mother used to say it, too," said the claimant, as he twisted the claim papers in his fingers. "You can call in the morning, if you like, and tell them the claim has been met."
"In a mysterious way," added the lawyer.
Neither this lesson nor any other part of this course is intended as an appeal to maudlin sentiment. But there can be no escape from the truth that success, in its highest and noblest form, brings one finally to view all human relationships with a feeling of deep emotion such as this lawyer felt when he overheard the old man's prayer. It may be an old-fashioned idea, but somehow I can't get away from the belief that no one can attain success in its highest form without the aid of earnest prayer. In this age of mundane affairs, when the uppermost thought of the majority of people is centered on either the accumulation of wealth or the struggle for a mere existence, it is both easy and natural for us to overlook the power of prayer. I am not saying that you should resort to prayer as a means of solving the daily problems that require your immediate attention. No, I am not going that far in a course that will be studied largely by those who are seeking the road to success that is measured in dollars. But may I not modestly suggest that you at least give prayer a trial after everything else fails to bring you a satisfying success? I have another, although very different, illustration of the effect of the Golden Rule and the power of prayer. 30 men, red-eyed and disheveled, lined up before a judge at the San Francisco Police Court. It was the regular morning company of drunks and disorderlies. Some were old and hardened. Others hung their heads in shame. Just as the momentary disorder of the bringing in of the prisoners quieted down, a strange thing happened. A strong, clear voice from below began singing. Last night I lay a-sleeping. There came a dream so fair. I stood in old Jerusalem, beside the temple there. Last night, it had been for all of them a nightmare or a drunken stupor. The words of the song were such a contrast to the facts that it came as a shock. The judge paused. He made a quiet inquiry. A former member of a famous opera company known all over the country was awaiting trial for forgery. It was he who was singing in his cell. In the meantime, the song went on, and every man in the line showed emotion. One boy at the end of the line, after a desperate effort at self-control, leaned against the wall, buried his face against his folded arms, and sobbed, "Oh, mother, mother!" The sobs, cutting to the very heart of the men who heard, and the song, still welling its way through the courtroom, blended in the hush. At length, one man protested. "Judge," he said, "have we got to submit to this? We are here to take our punishment, but this..." He, too, began to sob. It was impossible to proceed with the business of the court, yet the court gave no order to stop the song. The police sergeant, after an effort to keep the men in line, stepped back and waited with the rest. The song moved on to its climax. "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, sing, for the night is o'er. Hosanna in the highest, Hosanna forevermore." In an ecstasy of melody, the last words rang out, and then there was silence. The judge looked into the faces of the men before him. There was not one who was not touched by the song, not one in whom some better impulse was not stirred. He did not call the cases singly, but with a kind word of advice, he dismissed them all. No man was fined or sentenced to the workhouse that morning. The song had done more good than punishment could possibly have accomplished. You have heard the story of a Golden Rule lawyer and a Golden Rule judge. In these two commonplace incidents of everyday life, you have observed how the Golden Rule works when applied. A passive attitude toward the Golden Rule will bring no results. It is not enough merely to believe in the philosophy while at the same time failing to apply it in your relationships with others. If you want results, you must actively apply the Golden Rule. It will not avail you anything to proclaim to the world your belief in the Golden Rule while your actions are not in harmony with your proclamation, and you use it to cover a greedy or selfish nature. Even the most ignorant person will see you for what you are. Editor's Commentary. In their book, Be Loved for Who You Really Are, husband and wife psychology team Judith Shervin, Ph.D., and Jim Snikowski, Ph.D., offer an interesting variation on the traditional Golden Rule. They point out that in some circumstances, doing for someone what you would like them to do for you can have exactly the opposite effect to what is intended. The example they give in their own book is of a couple, each of whom has very different expectations of how they would like to be treated when they're ill. She expects to be cared for and catered to. He prefers to be left alone. So when she fussed over him and he ignored her, she was hurt and he was irritated. Yet each felt they were following the Golden Rule because each was doing for the other what they would prefer be done in that situation. Until they recognized this difference and discussed it, each had felt resentful of and disrespected by the other. Once they understood what the other would like, the issues were quickly resolved. It is true that in most of our day-to-day relationships, we cannot know what others would prefer. But with those we are close to, Judith and Jim suggest that a more golden rule is to do unto others as they would like you to do unto them. And if you don't think you know what they would like, you can always ask. Resuming Napoleon Hill's original text. Ralph Waldo Emerson was referring to the golden rule philosophy when he wrote the following. Human character does evermore publish itself. It will not be concealed. It hates darkness. It rushes into light. I heard an experienced counselor say that he never feared the effect upon a jury of a lawyer who does not believe in his heart that his client ought to have a verdict. If he does not believe it, his unbelief will appear to the jury, despite all his protestations, and will become their unbelief. This is that law whereby a work of art, of whatever kind, sets us in the same state of mind wherein the artist was when he made it. That which we do not believe, we cannot adequately say, though we may repeat the words ever so often. It was this conviction which Swedenborg expressed when he described a group of persons in the spiritual world endeavoring in vain to articulate a proposition which they did not believe. But they could not, though they twisted and folded their lips even to indignation. A man passes for what he is worth. What he is engraves itself on his face, on his form, on his fortunes, in letters of light which all men may read, but himself. If you would not be known to do anything, never do it. A man may play the fool in the drifts of a desert, but every grain of sand shall seem to see. And it was this same law that Emerson had in mind when he wrote this. Every violation of truth is not only a sort of suicide in the liar, but is a stab at the health of human society. On the most profitable lie, the course of events presently lays a destructive tax. Whilst frankness proves to be the best tactics, for it invites frankness, puts the parties on a convenient footing, and makes their business a friendship. Trust men, and they will be true to you. Treat them greatly, and they will show themselves great, though they make an exception in your favor to all their rules of trade. The following is from Bible Mystery and Bible Meaning by the late Judge Thomas Troward, who was the author of several interesting volumes, including the previously mentioned and recommended The Edinburgh Lectures. Once grant the creative power of our thought, and there is an end of struggling for our own way, and an end of gaining it at someone else's expense. For, since by the terms of the hypothesis we can create what we like, the simplest way of getting what we want is not to snatch it from somebody else, but to make it for ourselves. And since there is no limit to thought, there can be no need for straining, and for everyone to have his own way in this manner would be to banish all strife, want, sickness, and sorrow from the earth. Now, it is precisely on the assumption of the creative power of our thought that the whole Bible rests. If not, what is the meaning of being saved by faith? Faith is essentially thought, and, therefore, every call to have faith in God is a call to trust in the power of our own thought about God. According to your faith, be it unto you, says the Old Testament. The entire book is nothing but one continuous statement of the creative power of thought. The law of man's individuality is, therefore, the law of liberty, and equally, it is the gospel of peace, for when we truly understand the law of our own individuality, we see that the same law finds its expression in everyone else, and, consequently, we shall reverence the law in others exactly in proportion as we value it in ourselves. To do this is to follow the golden rule of doing to others what we would they should do unto us. And because we know that the law of liberty in ourselves must include the free use of our creative power, there is no longer any inducement to infringe the rights of others, for we can satisfy all our desires by the exercise of our knowledge of the law. As this comes to be understood, cooperation will take the place of competition, with the result of removing all ground for enmity, whether between individuals, classes, or nations. If you wish to know what happens to someone when they totally disregard the law upon which the Golden Rule philosophy is based, pick out anyone in your community whom you know to live for the single dominating purpose of accumulating wealth and who has no conscientious scruples as to how they accumulate that wealth. Study this person, and you will observe that there is no warmth to their soul, no kindness to their words, and no welcome to their face. They have become a slave to the desire for wealth. They are too busy to enjoy life and too selfish to wish to help others enjoy it. They walk and talk and breathe, but are nothing more than a human robot. Yet there are many who envy such a person and wish that they might be in their position, foolishly believing them to be a success. There can never be success without happiness, and no one can be happy without bringing happiness to others. Moreover, it must be voluntary and with no other objective than that of spreading sunshine into the hearts of those who are burdened. George D. Heron had in mind the law upon which the Golden Rule philosophy is based when he wrote, "We have talked much about the brotherhood to come, but brotherhood has always been the fact of our life, long before it became a modern and inspired sentiment. Only we have been brothers in slavery and torment, brothers in ignorance and its perdition, brothers in disease and war and want, brothers in prostitution and hypocrisy. What happens to one of us, sooner or later, happens to all. We have always been unescapably involved in common destiny. The world constantly tends to the level of the downmost man in it, and that downmost man is the world's real ruler, hugging it close to his bosom, dragging it down to his death." You do not think so, but it is true, and it ought to be true. For if there were some way by which some of us could get free, apart from others, if there were some way by which some of us could have heaven while others had hell, if there were some way by which part of the world could escape some form of the blight and peril and misery of disinherited labor, then indeed would our world be lost and damned. But since men have never been able to separate themselves from one another's woes and wrongs, since history is fairly stricken with the lesson that we cannot escape brotherhood of some kind, since the whole of life is teaching us that we are hourly choosing between brotherhood in suffering and brotherhood in good, it remains for us to choose the brotherhood of a cooperative world, with all its fruits thereof, the fruits of love and liberty. The World War ushered us into an age of cooperative effort in which the law of live and let live is meant to guide us in our relationships with one another. This call for cooperative effort is taking on many forms, not the least important of which are the Rotary Clubs, the Kiwanis Clubs, the Lions Clubs, and the many other organizations that bring men together in a spirit of friendly communication. For these clubs mark the beginning of an age of friendly competition in business. The next step will be a closer alliance of all such clubs in an out-and-out spirit of friendly cooperation. The attempt by Woodrow Wilson and his contemporaries to establish the League of Nations, followed by the efforts of Warren G. Harding to give footing to the same cause under the name of the World Court, marked the first attempt in the history of the world to make the Golden Rule effective as a common meeting ground for the nations of the world. There is no escape from the fact that the world has awakened to the truth in George D. Heron's statement that we are hourly choosing between brotherhood in suffering and brotherhood in good. The World War has taught us, no, has forced upon us, the truth that a part of the world cannot suffer without injury to the whole world. I mention this not to preach morality, but to point out that the underlying law through which these changes are being brought about is the Golden Rule philosophy. The world has been thinking about this rule for more than 4,000 years, and the benefits that come to those who apply it are now being realized. If you can grasp the significance of the tremendous change that has come over the world since the close of the World War, and if you can interpret the meaning of all the luncheon clubs and other similar gatherings which bring men and women together in a spirit of friendly cooperation, surely you will see that there is opportunity to profit by adopting the spirit of friendly cooperation as the basis of your own business or professional philosophy. And stated conversely, it must also be obvious to all who make any pretense of thinking accurately that failure to adopt the golden rule as the foundation of one's business or professional philosophy is the equivalent of economic suicide. From the editors. As noted in the previous lesson, many people at the time thought the First World War was not only the defining moment of their generation, but a turning point for the entire world. Just 10 years before, they had experienced the first large-scale, impersonal, mechanized war in which there was little chivalry or honor. And tanks, aircraft, submarines, bombs, poison gases, and scientifically engineered devices killed indiscriminately. The President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, believed the war had been so horrifying that leaders throughout the world could not help but see that negotiation and conciliation were preferable to another such devastating conflict. He proposed the creation of a League of Nations, an organization through which the countries of the world could come together and world leaders could reason together in a way that would make future wars avoidable. Napoleon Hill was a staunch supporter of Wilson's dream, but it was not to be. Even among the European allies, there was widespread disagreement about the Treaty of Versailles that had redrawn the borders at the end of the war. At home, President Wilson was unable to effectively convince the public at large that the United States should be responsible for defending the borders of foreign countries. Further, the Congress and Senate were not persuaded that America should be subject to the decisions of a world body and forego its right to act unilaterally. In 1920, the Senate refused to ratify the Treaty of Versailles. The League of Nations foundered. By 1932, Adolf Hitler's rise to power was assured, and a second, even more devastating worldwide war was all but inevitable. At the end of the Second World War, the hope flourished once again that the nations of the world could come together and future wars could be prevented. On June 26, 1945, 50 nations, including the United States, signed the charter that established the United Nations as a body dedicated to promoting peace, international cooperation, and economic and social development. Resuming Napoleon Hill's original text. Perhaps you have wondered why the subject of honesty has not been mentioned in this course as a prerequisite to success. If so, the answer will be found in this lesson. The Golden Rule philosophy, when rightly understood and applied, makes dishonesty impossible. It also makes all the other destructive qualities, such as selfishness, greed, envy, bigotry, hatred, and malice, impossible. When you apply the Golden Rule, you become at the same time both the judge and the judged, the accuser and the accused. Honesty, then, begins in one's own heart, toward oneself, and extends to all others with equal effect. Honesty based on the Golden Rule recognizes more than just expediency. It is no credit to be honest only when honesty is obviously the most profitable policy, so as not to lose a valuable client or be sent to jail for deception. But when honesty means either a temporary or permanent material loss personally, then it becomes an honor of the highest degree to all who practice it. Such honesty has its appropriate reward in the accumulated power of character and reputation enjoyed by those who deserve it. Those who understand and apply the Golden Rule philosophy are always scrupulously honest, not only out of their desire to be just with others, but also because of their desire to be just with themselves. They understand the eternal law upon which the Golden Rule is based, and they know that through the operation of this law, every thought they release and every act in which they indulge has its counterpart in some fact or circumstance with which they will later be confronted. Those who understand this law would poison their own drinking water as quickly as they would indulge in acts of injustice to others, for they know that such injustice starts a chain reaction that will not only bring them physical suffering, but will also destroy their characters, stain their reputations, and make it impossible for them to attain enduring success. The law through which the Golden Rule philosophy operates is none other than the law through which the principle of autosuggestion operates. If all your acts toward others, and even your thoughts of others, are registered in your subconscious mind through the principle of autosuggestion, thereby building your own character in exact duplicate of your thoughts and acts,
Can you not see how important it is to guard those thoughts and acts? We are now at the very heart of the real reason for doing unto others as we would have them do unto us. For it is obvious that whatever we do unto others, we also do unto ourselves. You cannot indulge in an act toward another person without having first created the nature of that act in your own thought. And you cannot release a thought without planting the sum and substance and nature of it in your own subconscious mind, where it becomes an integral part of your own character, modifying it in exact conformity with the nature of the act or thought. Grasp this simple principle, and you will understand why you cannot afford to hate or envy another person. You will also understand why you cannot afford to strike back in kind at those who do you an injustice. Likewise, you will understand the injunction, return good for evil. Understand the law upon which the golden rule is based, and you will also understand the law that eternally binds all mankind in a single bond of fellowship and renders it impossible for you to injure another person by thought or deed without injuring yourself. Similarly, the results of every kind, thought, and deed in which you indulge adds favorably to your own character. Understand this law, and you will then know, beyond room for the slightest doubt, that you are constantly punishing yourself for every wrong you commit, and rewarding yourself for every act of constructive conduct.